So today I'll tell you a little bit about our experiments with single molecules, single proteins, to be more exact. And this was done in collaboration with my student and postdoc, Wei Liu, and some people in the biology department at Riverside, who are now moved to the University of Alabama, who supplied us with the proteins and gave us a helping hand everywhere along the way. Okay, so I don't know about the composition of the audience. Of course, there's people who know, who are experts in biology, and then we have, I'm sure there are others who are need an introduction, so I put in a primer on biology. I'll tell you the motivation for experiments, how we do it, and what kind of biological insights we get, some biochemistry, and some physics we can do with these single molecule experiments. And we can also make some devices which pays our bills. So these, the proteins that we use are the ones in the neurons, and they're involved in neuronal communication. And here's a schematic of the neuron that I got off the NIH website where I learned all my biology from.
Not Wikipedia.
Yeah, I'm one step above. Not Wikipedia. Yes, not very far, but there. So the ones, let me see if we got a better picture. Okay, so what the proteins that I'm looking at are the ones that are involved in neurotransmission at the synapse. So what happens at the in the axon, which is the main part of the neuron here, the electrical signal, which is what it's a what's called the action potential. I must have a picture like that here. It's called the action potential, which is just an influx of sodium ions. And the sodium ion potential goes from minus 60 millivolts to close to 40, plus 40 millivolts. That's the signal on the axon. And so it travels down the axon. And the way it travels is not like an electrical current in a wire. You have an influx of sodium ions coming in as it travels down. So the channels, as the pulse moves down, it opens up channels in front of it, and the sodium ions keep coming in. And that's the action potential going through the axon.
That's plotting the potential along
the... Yeah, that's a potential along the axon at any one time, and the potential keeps moving down the axon like that. And then when it gets to the what's called the presynaptic terminal, which is the end of the neuron on this side, the sodium ion peak here triggers an influx of calcium ions. Calcium ions get inside, and that triggers the release of neurotransmitters into this gap. So these neurotransmitters are waiting in these bags called vesicles. That's a vesicle, just a bag of lipid membrane. And inside that bag are the neurotransmitters, small dots. And when the calcium ions come in, somehow these bags are drawn close to this plasma membrane. They fuse with the plasma membrane and release the neurotransmitters into the synapse. The neurotransmitters go on to these receptors. They go across the gap, go to these receptors, and trigger the action potential down on again. So that's how the signal communication happens. And the proteins that we're looking at are, here's a picture of the same thing that I told you about, let me see. Oh, I went to my primer again. Okay, so the proteins that we're looking at are the ones that are thought to be responsible for this fusion and the release of the neurotransmitters, and I'll tell you a little bit more about it. So before I go into those proteins, I had a primer on what a protein is and how a protein is made. I don't know if anybody wants to hear that. It might be boring stuff, but essentially, the DNA codes for these proteins, every three letters of the DNA codes for what's called one amino acid. And there are 20 of these, and you put 20 of these in a bead configuration, and you get a protein. Okay, it's a polymer of amino acids. Okay, and these polymers of amino acids can arrange themselves into two basic configurations. One's an alpha coil, and one's a beta sheet. The reason I didn't put up a picture of the beta sheet was I couldn't find one in time. But really is because it's not relevant to my talk. So so the key is we'll be looking at all about alpha coils. So proteins that we're going to be looking at alpha coils. So they are it's a coil configuration. So the polymer here makes itself into an alpha coil, and we're going to look at interactions between these alpha coils. So the proteins that I'm going to be talking about are made up of alpha coils, and how these coils get together. And that's an interaction I'll be concerned
with. It turns out that most of the proteins are completely disordered. That's something that's been coming out for the past few years.
Okay.
alpha quad and beta sheet that are actually minority configurations.
I see. Most of them just globular.
Maybe so.
Okay. But till they need to interact, then they make a configuration.
I mean, there's not no ordered configuration in there. It's just you saw that there's no alpha coil regions, no beta sheet regions.
So all the textbooks have to be revised, or what do you mean?
I mean, you know, some of them, of course, those that we know that are alpha coil or beta sheet, they will remain so. There's no need to.
But if they don't have a structure, then how are they going to have all these, all these nice
very
properties
good question.
That we talk about for protein, although we don't have all this lock and key and, specific interactions are not possible without structure, right?
It's, structure, it's a disordered structure. Mm-hmm. It's not clear how they, what they do, what's the function and so on. But it is transpiring more and more that the majority of proteins are disordered.
Disordered. Always or just before interaction? This is all well, like the alpha.
That's their native conformation.
Really? Mm-hmm. Okay, so obviously this textbook idea has to be revised. But okay, I'm going to follow the textbook idea.
Yeah, this
one is Wikipedia. That you got right. So, and I couldn't find a good beta sheet in the Wikipedia. okay. Okay, so here's the proteins. So here's a vesicle which contains the neurotransmitters, and it's stuck to this end of the neuron, the presynaptic membrane, by proteins. And typically, there are four which are involved. I'm listing only three here because the fourth one has to do with the calcium influx. That's what undergoes the transformation, and I'm not going to talk about this in this talk, so I left it out. So they're called SNAP proteins. They're standard proteins. They've been studied for a long time. Oh, yes, sure. Okay, yes. So there are four molecules involved, but the only three are I'm going to be talking about today, and for our purposes, we'll call them the green one, the blue one, and the red one, okay? Now, the red one is on the vesicle. The green one and the blue one are on the presynaptic membrane. And they get together and lead to this fusion and release of the neurotransmitters. And the things I'm going to be talking about is try to understand this interaction from using one molecule at a time and study the dynamics of the single molecule. That's the whole experiment about. Okay. So there is an X-ray structure for these three molecules, and the X-ray structure is about 10 years old, and it tells you, so these are all the alpha coils, the green, red, and the blue alpha coils, and the green one contributes two alpha coils to the whole structure, okay? The others contribute one coil apiece, and they're all tangled up into a rope, and that structure is what brings the vesicle close to the plasma membrane and bring a lot of fusion. So what happens here is somehow, when the calcium influx comes in, there's a change in the structure of this combination of four molecules that pulls this lipid membrane close to this lipid membrane, and thermal energy leads to the fusion of the two membranes, okay? And then the hole is opened up and all the neurotransmitters are released. So that's the model.
This is a generic mechanism?
This is...
synaptic vesicles?
Yes, in fact, all fusion. But rest of the body has different, they have different homologs of these proteins. Like, for example, some places have SNAP23 and so SNAP25, small changes in the structure. But this is thought to be a general mechanism for this fusion, which is technically known as exocytosis. Okay,
that'll be self-familiar.
Ah, good question. So that's why we all think so slowly, yes. So, the reason is it takes about a few hundred microseconds, okay, for the whole process to happen. Okay, and the key is what's interesting is, and I don't know where I learned this from, the NIH website or the Wikipedia, but or from a paper. But the key is that you go back here to this picture. These vesicles have to be waiting for the sodium pulse to come down. Okay, and the release of this neurotransmitters is what controls the brain function, right? So the learning process is controlled by how quickly these neurotransmitters are released. Now, so these bags have to be waiting, and they call it priming. They have to be primed and waiting for the false to come in, so there's a quick release of neurotransmitters. And so the learning process, so the more you learn depends on how many or how much of these neurotransmitters and how quickly they're released into the synapse. Okay? All right, I'll step back. Okay, so that's the whole fusion process called exocytosis. And the nice thing is it involves only one or a couple of sets of these molecules. So it's a single molecule process in the body. And the nice thing about single molecule techniques, of course, you need very small quantities. You don't need any labels. You don't need radioactive labels or fluorescent labels like they got a Nobel Prize for today. Right? We don't need those labels. That's our selling point. And measure the complete energy landscape in the molecular bond. I'm going to tell you how we measure the interaction energy along the alpha helix. Okay. So we use the same thing that we do for the Casimir force. So the technique-wise, we're no different, and that's why we can apply it. So instead of putting, the only difference is instead of putting, so we use this thin cantilever, which will bend to a very small force. In this case, it bends to the response of a molecular force, a single molecule force. Okay, that's the same idea. The only difference is, instead of having a sphere here, where we measure the Casimir force too, here we have a sharp tip on which we put one molecule, the green molecule, and on a plate we put the red molecule. We bring these two, we have this piezo here, which we move it up and make contact between the two, and wait till a bond forms. And once a bond forms, then we pull this sample down to this piezo, stretch the two molecules out, and study the interaction. So that's all the technique is. And
so it's the same method, except that here you have a non-equilibrium experiment.
Yes, yes, I'm going to get to that in the end. Okay, all right, yes. It's a non-equilibrium experiment, absolutely. So what happens is, before we start out, the cantilever is flat. There's no interaction between the red and the green. And when we bring the two together, when we push on each other, the cantilever bends like this, and we can detect the bending because the laser beam is moved one way. And then when we start pulling on each other, we're stretching the molecules, and the cantilever bends the other way, and we tell the interaction is happening. And then when it's broken, it straightens up again, so we know when it's broken, okay, when the molecular bonds are broken. So that's how we tell the interactions happen. And the technique itself is started out in 94 was the first demonstration of this technique. I mean, we're not the first. And there was a group at Naval Research Labs which did these first experiments. And then it was followed up. A lot of the development after that happened in Germany at the Max Planck in Munich by a person called Guab. And then there's been a lot of work after that following concurrently in the U.S. also with this technique. So the technique itself is about 10 years old, and we've been doing this for about 6 years. okay, so a couple of things we introduced to the technique was, one is how to attach these single molecules such that they're rigid. So what we do is we made these molecules, so here's a green molecule. We make a mutant version of the green molecule such that it has an amino acid called histidine in the end. The histidine binds to nickel. It usually binds to any divalent ion, but preferably to nickel. So if you put nickel on this sharp tip here, a little bit of nickel, which we have to control, and then pour this protein on top, it'll stick only at this end because that's the end that has the histidine. And it sticks so hard, the binding force of that is much stronger than the binding force between the two proteins. So that's one thing that we introduced, how to bind these rigidly. And so the same thing, we grow the red protein, a mutant version, with the histidine at the end, and then here's a glass plate on which there's a little bit of nickel, and we pour this protein on top, and it sticks only at that end. And in our case, that end is called the C-terminal. The proteins are labeled with two terminals, C terminal, the N terminal, and you start counting for the amino acids from N terminal, but we don't, that's all. So that's just for people who know biology. Excuse me. Yeah.
How do you know that the histidine, the one that's at the end, that's the only one that interacts with the synthase?
That's a good question. I mean, I'm going to get to that, and I'll tell you a little bit how we tell that stuff, but it's a good question. But we have, you know, we don't put one histidine, we actually have six histidines, so it really sticks, you know, strongly to the thing. So
they're not all at the end.
They're all at the end. We make the mutant version with all at the end. This is not an A2 protein. This is a special mutant version made with six histidines at the end. Okay. Yeah. So it sticks only at that end. See. So we can put the histidine here and stick it right here, or we can put the histidine at the other end of the thing and stick it right there. So we can flip it and do experiments, you know, flipping it around. So we do that also, okay? But in this case, it's stuck at the C terminal here, which is right there, okay? And how do we control single molecule behavior? The way we control single molecule is by controlling the density of the nickel. You know, so we have very little nickel on the tip. So this is the tip, and on which we have the green protein. And the way you see it lighted, because to the green protein we bind an antibody, which sticks only to the green protein, and the antibody fluoresces. It lights up. Okay, and that's how you see this bright spot. So the bright spots is, it means that there's this green protein on the tip. So this is a cantilever, and the tip is right there. And you see the bright spots telling you there's some green protein on there. And we control the density by controlling the nickel layer. Okay, so that's how we get few bright spots. And the same thing we do for the plate here. You see the bright spots, you know, with this protein. The green protein is called synaptobrevin 2. So that's why you see it labeled SB2. And the H6 is for the histidine 6, histidine at the end. And so you see the you know, we have only few bright spots telling we can control the density. And now, when you bring them together, we get only one bright spot interacting with another bright spot and get a single molecule interaction. So that's how we have control.
So this
is a biology way of telling. This is plus and minus. So this one has the protein, so it's lighted up. When you don't have the protein that's minus, there's no bright spots.
So that's just before you put it down or something?
Before you put it down. So you're comparing before and after pictures. That's all. Okay. And the same thing here, before and after pictures, so plus and minus. Okay. So here's how we do the experiment. So we bring this plate close to this tip and wait till the bond happens, and then we pull this tip down, okay, and stretch the bond out. And this is the kind of response we will get. So from B and C is when the tip is pushing on the cow plate. It's pushing on the cow plate and it's bending like that. Okay, that's B, C. So that's A, B. Then it breaks apart at B, comes to C. From C is where we stretch the molecule. Starting from C, we are stretching the molecule. So this is distance, the distance that we're pulling this down. That's this axis is a force axis. So C, from C, we start stretching the molecule till we get to D. At D, the molecule breaks and goes back to its equilibrium position. Now, how do we know this is happening? Is we compare the system when there's no green, when there's no red, and when there's no green or red. Here, I'll show you that here. So here, there's nothing on the tip. And there's the other part of the curve is missing, the CDE, okay? And we can see the same thing happens when there's no green, but we still put the 6-histidine to make sure the histidine is not messing us up. So that's that small piece you see there. The histidine is there, but there's no green molecule. And then we don't see that interaction again. And again, we do the reverse of that the red is missing, but only the histidine on the curve slip, and then you don't see the interaction again. So we check and make sure that the curve shows the interaction only when the two molecules are present. And how do you know it's single molecule? If you have multiple molecules, you'll see a repetition of the CDE. The CDE will repeat itself, telling us that you have two or three molecules involved in the interaction. Yeah.
How do you measure the distance?
How do you measure the distance? It's just piezo. We just calibrate the piezo.
Okay.
You know, so that tells us the distance.
So it's a relative distance.
It is a relative distance, yes. And the only way to tell is, when you start stretching the molecule, if the zero force is at zero. You know, because far away, we know how much the cantilever is bending. That's a zero force on the cantilever. And then, so when we start stretching the molecule, if you're at zero also, we know that's a zero stretch distance. Okay, so that's how we tell.
Can you put two on so you can get twice the force, or is it too close?
If the two of them are interacting, actually you don't always get twice the force. What happens is if both of them are at the same point, then you get one break and the other one will start up here and then go up like that. So you won't get twice the force, but you get somewhere in between. So two things we measure. How much force it takes to break the bond, that's the distance dE on this axis. dE will tell us how much force it takes to break the bond. It's about 240 piconewtons typically in this case. And then this distance CD tells us how much we have to stretch the two molecules before they break apart. Okay, those are the kind of measurements we can make.
These things depend on the time scale of the experiment?
Yes. Very good question. I'm going to get to that. You know, that's key. Okay? And that has something to what Rudy was saying about the equilibrium thing. And I'll discuss throughout my talk, but I won't get to it till the end. Okay. So the kind of measurements we make, the distance is a rupture force. That's so you got a histogram. So you keep repeating the experiment and you develop a histogram. And this distance CD, how much you stretch the molecule on this axis, you get a histogram too. Okay. So these are the measurements you make. And I told you about this already. And we can compare it to what happens. You have two, just the green and the red, And what is the role of the blue in the body? You can check by putting the blue on there and looking at the distribution. And you have the force distribution here and the extension. And the key thing you'll see is here, the mean value of the extension, the amount you've got to stretch, is only about 12 nanometers. Okay, but here, it's about 23 nanometers, only two molecules. So the idea of the third molecule in the body is to somehow pull the vesicle close to the plasma membrane to get ready for fusion, to prime it for fusion. So that's how what the blue molecule is doing in the body, okay, physiologically. Okay, okay. So this is just data. Okay, now, so the key is, as you were saying, what I haven't told you about is how fast we do the experiment. It's a non-equilibrium part of it. Okay, how fast we're pulling on the experiment, and how, what role that has to play in you know, how much force it takes to break the bonds. Okay, okay. Let me. Okay, so here's how we measure. Somebody asked you, how do we know what the distance measurement is, right? I think Andreas was asking me that. So here's a couple of ways we tell. Is, you know, this extension measurement, how meaningful it is. So here's a green molecule and the red molecule, and we measure an extension of 23 nanometers before they break. Now what we do is we make a mutant version of the green one which doesn't have this section of it, okay? So it's a truncated one. And then we do the experiment again, we see the same extension. That tells us biologically that this section is not involved in this interaction between these two proteins. Of course, it's there for a reason, but it's not important for here. Then what we do is we calibrate this extension. The way we calibrate this extension is we take a 20 amino acid region, this part of it, we make a copy, an artificial copy of the amino acids. Okay, we buy it from a company actually, and they send us the copy. And then we put it on the red one first. So if it registers, then it goes and sticks in the appropriate place on the red one. Okay? So that's why the blue one is covering this end of the red one. And then we make the measurements again. And we see that the change in extension actually corresponds to the length of this blue piece. So that's how we calibrate our extension, what we're doing. Okay. So we keep copying 20 amino acids of this, 3 nanometers of this protein, and stick it on different places on here and see the change in the extension measurement as we pull these two proteins apart. So that tells us a couple of things. One, that we understand what we're doing in terms of how we're pulling these proteins apart, and also tells us that if you look at these values here, if you cover up certain parts of this red protein, the interaction decreases dramatically. So that tells us that some parts of the protein are very important in the interaction and some are not. Okay, that's a biological function. Yeah.
You're going into so much detail about what is touching what. And
yeah.
Imagine that. How do you ensure that these things come in the registry?
You cannot. Absolutely. That's why you only talk about average values. That's why we get a histogram. And we cannot control the registry, absolutely. The way we can tell that we're not in registry is going back to any one of these measurements. You will see if you're not in registry, of course, this extension is going to change. We get a different histogram. I mean, that's the distribution of the histogram, the fact that we're not in registry.
So that histogram is for the same place repeatedly?
Repeatedly. You go on, yeah, repeating hundreds of times.
But okay. If you were to do the same with some other location, you would get a different curve.
You might get, you know, if you do it, the idea being that if you repeat enough times, the same curve is going to be repeated. You know, you'll be sampling enough random registries that you'll get the same histogram.
I mean, is it obvious that if you are slightly off, maybe not at all stick features there?
Yeah, you know, because you got to pull it only, in some cases, 12 nanometers, in other cases, 20 nanometers before they don't stick to each other at all. And actually, what we can tell is, when we repeat this experiment, about 25 times we can tell they're doing it on the same molecule because we get the same response, okay? And then somehow it breaks apart or something, and then we have to go look for another one and repeat it again about 20 times on that one, okay? So when you're repeating on the same one, there'll obviously be some, you know, there'll be registry mismatches, and we'll get a histogram. So we cannot control the registry, okay?
Do you try to optimize it somehow? Do you move it around a bit to find the best?
No, we don't. No, we don't. You know, this is all done in liquids also. This is done, you know, in, with the, you know, pH and salt and everything controlled to match the body thing. So we have very little control about any drift or anything in the system.
So I mean, these proteins are moving around themselves?
Yeah, they're wiggling themselves. Yeah.
You're going to tell us later what the interactions are. Is this electrostatics?
Or oh, yes, yes, yes. I'm going to tell you something. Yeah. Okay, so that's the so we learn about critical regions and okay, so here's the same thing with how we tell something about energetics. So with a three-molecule system, and this is a technical term, loading rate. That means we're changing the rate at which we apply the force. DFDT is being changed. Okay, so we pull this faster or slower, the bottom protein. That's all it means. That's this axis, and this axis is extension. How much we are pulling the molecules before they break. And what you see is the red squares is for the red, blue, and green proteins, the three-protein system. And the circles are for just the red and green proteins, okay? And you see the red and green proteins, if you pull slower, they fall apart faster. You know, that goes to the dynamics. Okay? That tells us that thermal energy is enough to break all the bonds here. So if you pull slower, thermal energy dissociates the system automatically. That's why it's dropping down. Whereas you have a three-molecule system, and the role of the third molecule in the body is to make sure thermal energy doesn't do this, okay? So you have to break the protein by hand. You have to pull it and break it. And there's a particular deep potential well corresponding to the position we have to break that's around 12 nanometers, okay? And so we get the the energetics of the binding between the two proteins from this kind of information. Okay, so this is just a picture that at 12 nanometers is a critical spot, and we can correlate that to what Rudy was asking just now, which is the bond. So these are the alpha helices. And if you look at the protein structure from the X-ray, there is three residues, one glutamine and three arginines. Other way around, one arginine and three glutamines, which you can see that here, three red dots and the blue one, which have an electrostatic bond, which is at this position here. And we can count up the length of the proteins up to this point and see if it adds up to the extensions we measure. That's a check, consistency check on our measurement. So, and we see that if you count up if all the molecules are oriented along the axis at which we pull, then if you count up all the proteins and add up the distances, we should get 17.3 nanometers. But we measure only 12, telling us that the proteins are not aligned along the axis. This goes to a little bit of what you were asking. The proteins are all twisted and they're not aligned to the axis. So we measure only 12, whereas if you're based on this electrostatic bond, we should measure 17 nanometers. So there's, you know, so we really don't know how they are oriented with respect to the tip. Okay, so there's uncertainty with that. And here's another way of, we measure the dynamics, the lifetime of the system, by putting, instead of changing the force constantly, instead of doing a DFDT equals constant, we keep the force constant. And the way we keep the force constant is the following. We put a second piezo on the cantilever, and then we pull this at a constant speed. We pull this at a constant speed. And so these are two proteins which are interacting. They're twisted together. Now, the response, the idea of the second piezo is to keep the force constant, which means to keep the tilt of this cantilever constant. Okay, that means to keep the force constant. The way it does it is, anytime a bond breaks, so as we are stretching these molecules, a bond breaks, the system relaxes. It gets slack. It gets soft. And then the force decreases. It changes the shape of this cantilever. So this piezo responds to pulls it up to make sure that it's tilted and the tilt remains constant. So this way it keeps the force constant. So the idea is then if you look at the response of this piezo, it'll tell us every time a bond breaks. Because every time a bond breaks, the system slacks. Okay, so we can look at the response of this piezo and know when a bond is breaking in the system. So we can look at individual bonds breaking in the system. That was the idea. So here's the response curve, and these kind of interactions, coil-coiled interactions, are called zipper-type interactions. Okay. Wow. So there are bonds all along the length of the coil, and every time a zipper breaks, which is then you get a bond breaking. So here's the response of the second piezo, and what you're seeing is the noise in the protein. So the proteins are being stretched and held at constant force. So because of thermal energy, they are moving the cantilever all over the place. So that's the noise you see, the thermal energy of the cantilever and the thermal energy of the protein that's held fixed between the two systems, the two tips. And the big jumps, we believe, correspond to when the bond breaks and the piezo has to respond and put a signal and pull it up and make the force constant. So we can look for changes, the variances, and they'll tell us whenever there is a bond breaking. Okay? So that's all we measure. We measure these big jumps and see if we can correlate it to a bond.
How do you determine that there's a big jump and not?
Yes, so we have to. Yes, so there's some processing involved here. And the processing is we have to take a, we put a window and measure the average fluctuations in the window and keep moving the window out till the average fluctuation goes through a jump, and that'll tell us, gee, you know, the average fluctuation is jumping, and we keep track of that.
And that's reversible?
That is reversible. Now, how does that, how do I, oh, we don't do it. It's, we break, it's gone.
It's gone.
It's gone. You start all over.
A few times.
A few times, yes.
Each time you see them.
Yes, and we average. We look for these jumps and average. And I'm going to, okay, that's a good question. That's my next slide. So that's the histogram of these jumps. And we can, and the biggest of these jumps happen around 12 nanometers, which should correspond to this electrostatic bond, this arginine glutamine bond, which is from the X-ray structure. Okay, it's in the right position. So, okay, so that's another way of telling the, you know, locating where the bonds are. Okay, and
may I ask you?
Yes.
Using the silly analogy of a zipper, you know, sometimes zippers get stuck.
Oh.
Which means you have basically two dislocations of opposite sign, or dislocation like object of opposite sign along the zipper, which would mean that some, and because the thermal fluctuations are strong, I assume you will see some of those. So I'm wondering whether you will see invariance.
You know, so I mean, obviously, in the here, the bond is a zipper interaction. Yes. So there's no, you know, the only way it gets stuck is the bond is very strong. So those will be the location of the strong.
Situation where there are two teeth inside one.
No, these are just, you know, smooth bonds along the coil along the protein. Yeah. Okay. So this is again the question about the dynamics. So we can do a couple of things. We can do some single molecule chemistry, which is what I'm going to talk about now, and then I'll talk about the physics to measure the energy. Okay. Some non-equilibrium physics. In single molecule chemistry, you can treat the system as a bound system at the bottom of potential well. Unfortunately, it's got a distributed bond. We're going to treat it as a single bond because that's all we know how to do. It's a phenomenological model. So it's just an Arrhenius type approach here. And so this is the barrier for the bond, EB, and it's at the bottom of the potential well. This KD is the thermal atom frequency that gets it over the barrier. Okay. And you know, you can do it in liquids or air, and there are different constants for this KD. But this KD can be related to the change in entropy of the system, you know, the single bond system. Okay, so what happens when you apply a force? According to this model, what's going to happen is the barrier is going to be lowered, okay, so thermally the system can escape over the barrier. Okay, this is the phenomenology. And so what you're going to do is you're going to lower the barrier. So there's a new barrier, which is lowered because of the force F. F is being applied. And the amount you lower it depends on the force times the barrier width. So this is the model. And so you have a new lifetime. And so if you study the change in the lifetime as a function of the force, you should be able to pull out all these terms, the barrier, which will correspond to the enthalpy of the interaction. Okay? Okay. So you can go through this model. So all that you do is get the histogram of the force distribution. You look at the peak in the histogram. The peak in the histogram is related to, you can make a plot of the peak, the change in the peak in the histogram as a function of the rate of change of force, and the slope will be related to the barrier width, and the intercept will be related to the lifetime. So you can pull this information from a plot of the peak force as a function of the rate of change of force applied. Okay, I'll skip all this stuff. Okay, so this is typically how you do it. So this is a force as a function of the rate of change of force, dFdt, for the three-molecule or two-molecule system. And from this, from looking at the intercept and the slope, you can get the information about the barrier and the lifetime and stuff. So that's the kind of biochemistry information you can get. Okay, and you can do the same thing with the constant force setup that I told you. Since you're applying constant forces, you can apply different constant forces and plot the lifetime as a function of the lifetime as a function of the force applied, and the coefficient will have the automatically the unperturbed lifetime here. Okay, so we can do that analysis too and compare the two. So this is a comparison of the two methods, constant force, a constant rate of change of force, and we get reasonable consistency between the two approaches, telling us that, you know, at least on average our experiments are consistent. Okay. Okay. And the other thing we can do is we can you can change the temperature. By changing the temperature, of course, we change the interaction energy between the two, okay? And we get different, therefore, that's why we get different slopes at three different temperatures. We do the experiment at room temperature, which is 24 Celsius, 14 Celsius, and 4 Celsius. We get three different slopes telling us three different lifetimes and three different barrier widths. Okay? And from this, we solve the Arrhenius equation to get the barrier, that's all. Okay? So we just get a barrier for the. And the energy is on the order of, the delta H is on the order of 33 kT for the two molecule system and 43 kT for the three molecule system. So we can get these kind of numbers. Okay, and we can do consistency checks, you know, since we're doing these two experiments separately, you know, the change in the delta G's will be related to the rate of change of the, is related to the rate at which the two, the interaction changes, so we can take the ratio and relate it to the change in the delta G's, and the measured values and the calculated values are consistent. So this is just a consistency check. Okay, and we can also count all the amino acids. You know, this is the amino acids involved. I don't want to go through all the letters. And you can count them up and calculate the energies and look them in the literature and make sure that we're consistent. The values of energies we get are consistent. That's just another consistency check that the energies are okay. Okay, so the last part I want to cover is we can do the, try to get, since it's a non-equilibrium experiment, as a couple of you pointed out already. Now, how do we obtain equilibrium values from non-equilibrium experiments? And we can apply some of the fluctuation theorems that are out there to get these equilibrium values. And the one thing that I'm going to be talking about today is the Jarzynski equality, okay, which I believe somebody has already talked about here. And so the way it goes is to calculate the equilibrium delta G, you find out, you measure all the non-equilibrium work done, Wn. Okay, you keep repeating the experiment, measure the Wn's. You get a distribution of the Wn's, so this is the probability, the fractional amount of time that the work Wn is required to break the bonds. And you calculate this average of the exponential average. This is the exponential work done, this is the exponential average, and that should correspond to the exponential exponent of the delta G. So that's the theorem, okay, or Jarzynski equality. So the question that arises is, how big is this number? You know, how many times do you have to repeat this experiment to get a realistic value of delta G? That is a question that we want to address, okay? Can you even do this experiment enough times to get an equilibrium delta G? That's a question. Okay, there is one prior experiment on this, applying the Jarzynski theorem, and that's with an experiment by Bustamante, where they took a single RNA and pulled on the RNA, and they're able to do that reversibly, whereas they pull on it very slowly and put it back and show that it's reversible. Pulling it and putting it back is reversible. Therefore, they had an independent measurement of the delta G automatically from reversible pulling. And then they pull it irreversibly and do this equality out and show those two values match. So there's a prior experiment on that from 2003 or so. So our version was, we cannot do the same thing. We cannot do it reversibly because we have two different proteins here, and we're pulling them apart, and they break apart, and we can't put them back together. You know, it's a completely different thing. So we cannot do it reversibly. So there's no check for us whether the values we get by applying the equality gets to a reversible value. So we took a different approach on how to check this. And what we did is the following. So the question we want to address is, how large should n be for us to get to the adiabatic limit to get the reversible value? Okay. So from what I told you, here's a measurement, here's a force as a function of molecular extension, and the work done in pulling these molecules apart is the area under this curve here. Okay, that's the work done. Now, so that's the W sub n. We're going to repeat this measurement. One assumption that we're making is we're pulling on these molecules like this, and we're assuming that the force that we apply is along the bond axis, that the work is force times distance, and this cosine theta is 1. That's an assumption in our analysis. Okay, we don't know what this is. Okay, a priori, we cannot tell what this is. We have enough new experiments going on where we're trying to vary this cosine theta a different way and try to address this. But at this experiment, we have no idea what this cosine theta is. Okay, so this is a work distribution. So we put into the Jarzynski equality and get a delta G. So what we're looking at here is a delta G on this axis as a function of 1 over the pulling velocity. So here, on this side, we're pulling fast. Here, we're pulling very slowly, okay? And this is an average of about 54 experiments at each point, right? So this is the data points. The solid line is just a fit to the data point. It's not a theory curve, okay? And so only the data points are important. Now, what happens is when you pull fast for this data point, the delta G is very high, okay? Saying that we don't have enough there's a sampling error. The number N is not large enough.
It's not delta G, it's the apparent delta G.
This is apparent delta G. This is an irreversible delta G.
Delta G, that's the beauty of Wierzynski equality. The real delta G doesn't depend on the fact that you do non-equilibrium measurements.
Yes.
As long as you do enough.
Enough, exactly. So our question is, what is enough? You know, experimentally, you have to know what is enough.
That's the very famous point.
Yes, yeah, absolutely right. As long as you do it infinite number of times, you will get the right delta G. But our question is, what is that large number?
That may depend on rate.
That will depend on rate. That's what I'm trying to address. Yes, that's what I'm trying to address. Yeah, that will depend on the rate. And so for 54 pulls, if you pull it so fast, we are not there. That is the point. Okay, so 54 times is not enough. We have to do it a lot more times. We are pulling it fast. But if you pull it slower and slower, for example, if you start pulling at this speed, then 50 times is enough because you're getting to this asymptotic limit, which is the adiabatic limit. So at this speed of pulling, 50 times is good. It's as good as infinity.
Infinity slow speed, once is enough.
Once is enough. So because that's a reversible limit. I mean, so we can't get to the whole idea is because the graduate student will have to stay up a long time to do that experiment, right?
Yes.
So we have a finite amount of time, so we have to do the experiment and find out if we got the equilibrium delta G. So that, and how big it is, it's 50 times.
Actually, there is a check that the dissipated work, that is the difference between the average work that you've done,
yes,
under the actual delta G,
dissipated.
Is related to the variance of the work if you are in a sufficiently slow limit. So this is a check that you can do. If you are in a limit in which the distribution is close to a Gauss, then this relation, which is pretty robust, tells you that you are that you are estimating correctly.
I should talk to you. Okay. All right. Very good. Yeah. Okay. So for us, we just have to, we pull it slower and slower and make sure that it doesn't change. That tells us, we're reaching the adiabatic limit. That was a check here. And what we did, and how we parameterized this was to say that when you pull it fast here, when you're pulling things fast, it takes us only 27 milliseconds to break the bonds on average. Okay. Whereas the lifetime that we measured independently is 180 milliseconds. So if you pull it, so what is fast? It's fast when you break it much faster than the natural lifetime of the bond. Okay? And what is slow is the reason you reach the adiabatic limit is when you pull, the time taken to break the bonds is much longer than the natural lifetime of the system. Then you can quickly get to the adiabatic limit with very few pulls. You sample the probability distribution very well. So that's the that's the conclusion we got to from this one. So on the way we did a second check on whether this is correct by changing the temperature. So we change the temperature, which means we change the lifetime. Okay, so we make this much bigger by going to a lower temperature. Then, even at this speed, we are not much greater than the lifetime, and we will not be at the adiabatic limit. So that's another check of how we do this. And here's the data from that. So here's the delta G at the different speeds, the pulling velocity. And these are three different temperatures. The black one is what I showed you, it's the room temperature, where the lifetime is 180 milliseconds. If you go 10 degrees less, so 14 Celsius, then the lifetime almost doubles. Okay, so we can change the lifetime by cooling it down. So it's 4 Celsius, it's almost 2 seconds. Okay, so almost 10 times bigger. So we can change the lifetime, and you can see that at the lower temperatures, we never get to the adiabatic limit, even though we are pulling slower and slower, which means the number N is not sufficient, okay? Because the lifetime has gone up and our pulling speeds is not bigger than the lifetime. Okay.
Can you check whether those lifetime ratios are proportional to the exponential of the temperature ratios?
The lifetime ratios are, the exponent of kT, yes, sure. Yeah. Now that'll match up here from these ratios, yes. So, but still there's a problem here. So this is what we get from the Jasinski value, and this is what we get from the phenomenological model, which is also a phenomenological model, so we don't know the difference. The reason we think that we got this is higher than this is even though we are getting this is an asymptotic value, so it should be an adiabatic limit, but the reason it's larger is because we always use this cosine theta factor to be 1, whereas in reality it's probably a lot less than 1. Okay? So we're not pulling the molecules along the axis of the bond. There's, you know, we don't know the configuration of the molecules when you're pulling on them, so that's a problem. Okay, so that's as far as the science is concerned. And this is what this experiment is what paid the bills, and I'll tell you.
Botox.
Botox, yeah. Okay. So you know the botulinum is toxin. Toxin botulinum is a poison which paralyzes you, and that's what you know gets rid of wrinkles because it causes local paralysis. Okay, and I can tell you a little bit more how it does that, but it mostly comes through food poisoning, and it paralyzes you by preventing the release of neurotransmitters. Okay, and the way it paralyzes you by preventing that is it goes in, there are 5 versions of this Botox. So the 5 different bacteria figured out different places to cut the green one or the red molecule or the blue molecule. Okay, so they cut them up so there's no release of neurotransmitters. That's how you get paralyzed. So we did a simple experiment, which is like the Casimir force measurement, okay? The same thing, which is we attached the bead here to the tip of the cantilever using the green molecule and the red molecule. We put the red molecule on the bead, the green molecule on the cantilever, we bring the two together and the bead hangs off the cantilever. Okay? Then we put Botox into our cell and it comes and chews up the red molecule and the bead drops. So that's sort of the sensor there. And it's very precise because it's only few molecules that need to hold up the bead because it's in water, because of buoyancy, the beads are not heavy. And we can look at the resonant frequency shift and tell that there is Botox in the system. So that's our and that's the conclusions. Okay.
So what is the nature of this interaction?
It's a coil-coil interaction.
I know, but microscopically, is this hydrophobic, electrostatic?
Oh, it's there's both. There's hydrophobic along the chain, but there is one electrostatic bond which gives you the registry. And this actually goes back to Mehran's question. You know, there is registry because of this electrostatic.
That's the strongest one.
That's the strongest one. That's the depotential well that we see at the 12 nanometer interaction. So that gives you registry. So without that registry, the bond will be much weaker. Okay. And without the registry, the vesicle is not going to come closer to the plasma membrane to give you the thermal fusion. Okay. You need that registry.
This seems to be very similar to the DNA unzipping experiments that they did.
Yes. Yes.
France and then you just
yes. I just wrote a proposal on DNA unzipping and doing that using the fluctuation theorem inequalities and see if they match up with the energies that they measure biochemistrically. That's my proposal.
Which fluctuation theorem is that?
The Jasinski primarily. Yeah.
So would you have enough accuracy here to actually see the base sequence as
important? That's a hope. That's a hope using the technique, the constant force.
Do you estimate it maybe? Is this
based on what we've done here, we should be able to tell that, yes. Yeah.
So other people have been coding molecules by attaching beads and
yes.
Moving a laser light.
Yes.
Could you contrast or sort of?
Okay, good question. See, the nice thing about the bead. The bead experiment, that's optical tweezers, okay, and there's a lot of work on that for the last 15 years, right? And the nice thing about that is the sensitivity is much bigger. They have 1 piconewton or fraction of piconewton sensitivity, okay? That's the advantage. The disadvantage is, since you have to hold these beads in a laser focus, okay, and there's 2 laser focuses sometimes and 1 laser focus, the beams are very big. So the interacting proteins have to be far away from the laser, and the beads are very big too. They're microns, okay, usually 5 microns or so. So which means that you have to hold the beads, and from the bead there has to be what's called a linker, a long, usually a DNA or a polymer, some other long polymer, long DNA, long RNA, before what you want to study, the interacting region, okay? So now if you want to look at the elastic properties, you have to somehow subtract out this linker interaction, okay? That's what makes it complicated to study the mechanics. Because its linker is so long and dominates everything. So unless you know your system precisely, it's hard to subtract it out. So that's the advantage is the sensitivity, the disadvantage is the fact that you've got to use a long linker. Okay? And what we have done here is we got rid of the linker. We have only 6 histidines that are holding this whole protein to the tip. Okay? So that's the advantage of what we have done here. Okay? But the AFM work in general in the past also used linkers, but shorter linkers. But here in our work, we don't use any linker at all. So we can study the mechanical interaction without having to worry. It's unambiguous. Okay. So that's an advantage. But the disadvantage is our sensitivity is not as high as in the Beta experiments.
At the beginning, you mentioned that voltage plays a role in setting this off. So is there any way to apply voltage here?
In the salt solution, no. Remember now, it's not a voltage. It is a ion concentration. Uh-huh. It's effectively a voltage, but it's not really a voltage. It's an ion concentration. Change in ion concentration.
Can you do that?
Yes, that we can do. And that we have done. Yes, so we study the role of, change the calcium concentration in the cell and study how the interaction changes as a function of calcium ion concentration. Yes.
And what do you see?
And what do we see? We see that the fourth protein, which I didn't talk about here, synaptic tagmin, has a calcium dependence, and we can tell how strong the calcium dependence is.
What about just sodium chloride?
Sodium chloride, we have it already there. That's at the body, pH. We can maintain the pH and the ion concentration exactly to be the body concentration.
Okay, but if you change it,
sodium concentration doesn't have anything with these three proteins. So, I take that back. We studied. I don't know if we didn't do a serious study of sodium concentration only, okay? But the thing we did carefully was the calcium concentration because that's what triggers the fusion, and that for sure has with only one protein, not the other three. Now, sodium, we just did one yes and no, and that doesn't have an effect.
Because you said there has to be some electrostatic registry.
Yes, yes.
So if you have more salt, of course, you would
yes,
kill it.
Yes, yes. The electrostatic here, the way the electrostatic comes about, you're right, you can screen the salt. But here what happens is the two coils get together. They exclude the water from the whole region, okay? And the Coulomb interaction gets to be stronger, 80 times stronger if the dielectric constant of water is 80. Okay, so the way the system falls apart is by letting water in. So when you break these two coils out, the water gets in there, the dielectric constant changes, and kills the electrostatic interaction exactly like you said. Okay, but for the interaction itself, the water is excluded.
Is that what the calcium is doing?
No, the calcium is actually doing something different. Calcium actually changes the shape of one of the proteins and therefore pushes it into the plasma membrane for thermofusion to happen. Yeah?
I don't understand your cosine theta factor.
Okay.
If I do things in equilibrium, really it doesn't matter where I put it. There's a field energy difference, there's an amount of work that I have to do. Are you saying that there is some work that you are not measuring if theta is not equal to zero?
I'm just saying that I'm not applying the force. I'm applying the force at an angle to the bonds. I'm not applying it along the bonds.
Yeah, but
only one component of the force is acting on the bonds, is all I'm saying.
But then the extension gets multiplied by 1 over cosine. Okay.
I don't understand. The bond breaks, the extension shows up all the time. Why should the extension change? Because it's not, you're not pulling it entropically. Maybe you're thinking, there's no entropic stretching here.
No.
Okay.
Mechanically,
yeah.
There is a certain amount of work that one has to do to break something.
Correct.
And then it doesn't matter whether this thing is hanging over there, I put it right on registry or from an angle, I have to do the same amount of work. Mm-hmm. Unless, because of the procedure that you're doing, there's some component of the board that you're not seeing. Is that what is happening?
I was just thinking, if I pull on a string at a different angle from then along the bond, only one component of the force gets along the bond, is all I'm thinking. Okay, you're saying somehow it goes into the extension. Do we measure the extension in the direction of the
force?
Yeah, so, we cannot tell, but, the only way it's calibrated by putting those small proteins there, we can tell that it's, there's the extension is not entirely along the axis of pulling, the protein is bent. It's not, what I'm saying is the protein is not it's not like this where, you know, these are the bonds, so I'm not, and this is the direction I'm pulling it in. It's not stretched like this. It's, you know, somehow, you know, it's bent over. And therefore, the extension is not completely along the axis of it which I'm pulling.
Yeah, but the displacement of the tip mm-hmm. of the AFM is measured in one direction, and this is the, if this is the direction in which the force is applied, then this is the work, independently of what the molecule does. This is.
So I was thinking the force is going to be transmitted through this because of this curvature. I was thinking there's only a component of the force that's being applied to the bond. No?
I would say that definition of work is product of the force and displacement.
Yeah,
the direction of
force. The direction of the force.
By definition.
Yeah. So there's no angle associated with this. If there's registry between the tip and the thing. But if there's no registry between the tip and the, you know, if one is like this, the other is being pulled, you know, somewhere else, right? Because, you know, then also is the same thing going to happen?
The anchors might be not aligned. I mean, one molecule might be anchored here, and one might.
Yeah,
be anchored
the, yes, that's what I was trying to show here. Yeah.
And the initial and final state are not the same. Is that?
I mean, you have both the force and the displacement in the same direction if the anchors are aligned.
Yes, the anchors are not aligned, which is obviously happen all the time, right? Then there'll be an angle. Yeah.
Okay, so there's some strain energy already.
Right. Right. Yes.
In this structure.
When you start out.
So that's what I was saying. The initial state
yes.
is different.
It's different, yes. Yes. And we cannot control that.
Unless you make the anchors light up.
Yes. You know, so one experiment we're doing is to move in the plane when we're doing the experiment to see if the distribution is changing. That's the experiment we're doing now. To see if this registry happens and what the effect of this registry is.
But the work is supposed to be the work that we put into the system in order to break the bond.
Correct.
It should be independent.
It should be independent of the angle in which it's applied and the registry.
Because just unless there's a certain amount of work that goes somewhere else. But I don't know where it goes.
Well, it'll go into this. My way of thinking is going into the system, in the surrounding. So you're doing work on the. On the water, if there's water all around.
So the cantilever is deflected in another direction, up and down?
Yes, I mean, no, when they start out, there's a strain to the molecule, inner molecular system, because they're not aligned. The tip of the cantilever and the two molecules, the bottom of the two molecules are not aligned. You're starting out with a certain strain to it.
So
because we cannot control.
You just the sample to the tip, right?
Yes, so if you could move it in the plane and align them, and that's the kind of experiments we do now, and try to get rid of this. But right now, in this experiments, we have no control of that.
In this experiment for Botox, is it just that you measure a critical concentration of Botox, or can you measure the quantitative?
Yeah, we can measure quantitatively here. You know, time taken for the ball to fall as a function of
concentration. As a function of concentration.
Concentration, yeah.
I have a slightly tangent angle on this discussion. This is not really about biology, but your force sensitivity on this and the other experiments you described is somewhere around the pike in the brain.
Yes.
What is it that determines how sensitive? And I've certainly heard of some kinds of measurements which can get atomic.
Well, you know, in our case, it's a cantilever flexibility, right? The thinner you make your cantilever, the higher the force sensitivity. Okay. But then you have to contend with the averaging the thermal noise out of the system.
All right, so one thing you need to be able to get more force sensitivity would be cold. You can cool things down.
Cool things down will get you the noise down. It'll get rid of the noise, yes. But you can't do it in biology.
No, right.
So, but if you're doing a Casimir force measurement like we do them at low temperature. So we cool. They do that.
Do you find in practice that you can easily get a higher sensitivity?
Well, yes. I mean, you'll win. So, for example, you go from 300 Kelvin to it'll go by square root of the change in temperature, right? So, if you go from 300 to 3, then you'll change by a factor of 10 the sensitivity.
And the atom newtons
that came around,
I think that was a difference.
The atom newtons is the ultimate sensitivity, okay, of the system. And
I think there might have been a mechanical resonance.
And then they use very small, very high frequency cantilevers, okay, to get the atom newton sensitivity. So that's how you increase the sensitivity in a cantilever based system. For the bead system, it depends on the laser focus, the gradient, okay? And the noise there is the scattered light, so they have to analyze the scattered light, noise and scattered light to get that sensitivity.
On the other hand, I mean, you do like forces of various kinds stronger if you have water because it's a bi dielectric, right?
Yes.
So in some ways, being warm enough to have water, a liquid medium, would actually make the forces bigger that you're trying to measure. So there's some kind of a balance going on here.
You know, the water actually reduces electrostatic forces. It reduces.
Reduces them.
Yes, because the epsilon, the permittivity comes in the denominator.
So
you don't want water.
That's not your line.
I mean, cold. We do the Casimir force measurements at low temperature. We do those. Okay. Very high forces. There's a group in actually in San Jose, IBM Almaden is a group that does high forces at, and there's a group at Caltech, very small forces. Yeah. And actually, Santa Barbara, actually UCSB has one. Andy McClellan at Santa Barbara does it too.
I have a little bit of a problem with this argument that water is actually excluded from space between the two molecules. And when you do experiments in ordered phases of proteins or DNA and so on, it turns out that it's almost impossible to exclude water, let's say the last layer of water. If you know the osmotic pressures like on the order of 1,000 atmospheres, you still cannot do that because it's so tightly bound to all these charged groups and so on. So here I would have my doubts that you really expelled water out.
You're probably right, but this is the model, literature model, which of course it makes heuristic sense, but you're probably right. I mean, it's impossible to exclude water.
Rule of thumb is you cannot get rid of water in biomolecules. There's always at least a layer of water on the surface that you really have to go to drastic means to get rid of it.
That's entirely possible. Sounds like. Okay.